This is New Times Radio. Today's program is brought to you by Tanya Starcevich of Canyon Coastal Estates. For all your real estate needs, call Tanya Starcevich at 310-739-4216. Welcome to Framed, Conversations on the Constitution. My name is Brian Chapman. We'll be joined shortly by Jimmy P. Morgan, a retired history teacher and budding constitutional scholar and beloved Topanga New Times contributor. We will be resuming our conversation about the origins of the Constitution to discuss today the Articles of Confederation. If you landed here accidentally and you haven't heard the first episode yet, you may want to go and hear that one first, because we're trying to tell the story in a linear fashion. But that's up to you. Otherwise, here's the show.
Following the American Revolution and the United States gaining its independence from the United Kingdom of Great Britain, there was a constitution in place called the Articles of Confederation. And that also was a plan of government. And if you're going to ask the trivia question, the first constitution of the United States is called the Articles of Confederation. We hold our own constitution in such high regard that we just call that the Constitution, as if it has been the only one, but no. And understanding how the Articles of Confederation came to be helps us understand the problems that the U.S. Constitution, a new plan of government, strives to solve. Articles of Confederation are basically an agreement among the states that together had agreed to fight the war against Great Britain. So it was that government, the Second Continental Congress, under the Articles of Confederation. There was no president at that point. There was a president of the Continental Congress, but that was more like the Speaker of the House of Representatives. So there was no singular person in charge except for the mystical, quiet leadership of George Washington. His presence almost served as a guiding force without all the bombast that we might associate with presidents or leaders of the executive.
His role at that point had just been a leader on the battlefield, but he had the support of the Second Continental Congress politically and economically. And later, his calm style of leadership would be instrumental at the Constitutional Convention. So the Articles of Confederation, tell us a little about that.
The Articles were basically an agreement among 13 separate individual sovereign states. And so it didn't create a nation so much as they created an alliance between South Carolina and Massachusetts and Virginia, 13 different new states, in order to fight the war against Great Britain. It's the Articles of Confederation and the Second Continental Congress that actually draft the Declaration of Independence. But they're doing it as 13 separate entities. As the war is being fought, as in many cases when a people, a group of people, or a people that might otherwise be divided over different issues like different types of economies or different cultures, or one is relying on slavery and the other is not, having a challenge to face together brings them together in a way. So the Articles of Confederation was really a product of the desire to get rid of Great Britain, to get rid of the mother country and establish, not just declare, but establish an independent United States. So when the war was won and Great Britain recognized the right of the United States to exist, and the war was no longer the unifying force it was during the American Revolution, some problems began to emerge with this Articles of Confederation.
What sort of problems?
Primarily, there was no strong executive. There was no, you want to say president, you could say king, a singular figure that operates in the system of government as a leader, but operating with the representative branches of that government as well. So there was no strong singular figure. And there's a good reason for that. He just fought a war to get rid of the king. So there's a lot of hesitancy to even want to have a singular government or even to have a strong national government. People at the time didn't refer to themselves as Americans. They didn't think of themselves as Americans. They were united in the war effort, but Thomas Jefferson was a Virginian, and John Adams was from Massachusetts, and Benjamin Franklin was from Pennsylvania. And so for them to refer to themselves as an American, as we might do today, that took shape later. And the best symbol of that to help people understand that, well, how can you have, 13 states, are they a country? What is a state? The answer is currency. Following the American Revolution and before it's realized that a new plan of government is needed, each of the states printed and circulated their own money. And so you might have some Pennsylvania dollars and some North Carolina dollars and some Georgia dollars and New York dollars. And if you're traveling and trading and interacting, it's as if you have to manage the currency confusion.
Well, what I owe you, friend?
That'll be $125.
Uh-oh. Y'all don't take Virginia dollars, do you?
Sir, you find yourself in Pennsylvania. Your money's no good here.
Dang.
The best way to understand this, because many people today have a general idea of how the European Union works. And if you're old enough, you remember when Germany had their own currency and France had their own currency. Italy had their own currency, and they're very close to one another. They trade with one another. They travel back and forth with one another. So that created problems. The solution for the European Union was to create the euro. And so that singular currency in Europe, in the European Union today, brings the states of Europe, dare I say, states of Europe, because as we look at how Europe is organized today, it's almost on a path to becoming a singular country. The European Union isn't quite a singular country. It's got a separate government, much like the United States had under the Articles of Confederation. It doesn't have a lot of power. Germans don't like being told what to do from the European Union. They don't want the rest of Europe to tell them what to do. This is much like the United States under the Articles of Confederation. One of the obvious problems that had a remedy was to establish a common currency. And that's by the time we get to meeting and gathering to create a new constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation, establishing the sole right to print currency, to print and coin money, is the exclusive responsibility of the federal government of the United States. It was necessary to create a stronger central government, and that's what the war had just been fought to get rid of. So there was a lot of apprehension, but the problems were many. We kind of think of the United States as the most powerful country on earth, and it has been for a long time. You could go back, to 1898, 1900, when America becomes a world power, begins expanding its borders into the Pacific Ocean and into the Caribbean. Post-World War II, 1940s America, we are the most powerful nation on earth, militarily, economically. And so for anyone alive today that lives in the United States, and for a lot of people that live outside the United States and would like to live here, on a lot of different levels, America has been the most powerful nation on earth. In the 1780s, not even close. It was a weak country. The victory over Great Britain was accomplished only because of the assistance of the French and the alliance with the French, who provided a navy, which was instrumental in winning the war because the United States basically had no navy. It had a couple of frigates. And so the assistance of the French was critical. And the rivalry between the French and the British gave the French an ideal opportunity to stick their finger in the eye of the British by helping the Americans win the American Revolution. When the war was over and the British surrendered, there was an attitude among the British that, well, okay, we surrendered, we're going to pull our soldiers home, but little time will pass and we'll come back and reclaim what is rightfully ours. So there's an attitude among the British in the 1780s, 1790s, and all the way actually to the War of 1812. That's kind of the culmination of this idea of Britain still planning to come back and reclaim its territories, or never really having felt like it gave up the colonies. The United States is in a precarious position. And so in order to prepare for an inevitable fight, That's what the War of 1812 was, basically a second American Revolution. A generation later, after the American Revolution, was Britain returning to reclaim what was theirs. The United States had to get their act together to secure unity within the country. And currency is a great symbol of that.
What were some of the other problems with the Articles of Confederation?
The federal government didn't have the power to raise taxes. So the taxing power resided with the individual states. And if you know anything about taxes today, the federal government raises taxes and funds the military. So any military that the United States had at that point resided with the individual states. When you think about Second Amendment issues today, the idea of a militia or a state having some kind of military control, this goes back to the origins of the United States under the Articles of Confederation. The history of the Second Amendment, securing the right to bear arms, is directly tied to a United States that's not united under United States Constitution. It's loosely aligned under the Articles of Confederation. The Articles left no means by which the country could raise an army. The states operated more as independent countries, and dealing with foreign nations then was a ticklish situation. If Great Britain or France or Spain wanted to make a deal with South Carolina to buy South Carolina cotton that was favorable to them, perhaps their membership in these United States of America was not so beneficial after all. Remember, the United States at this point is basically 13 states along the eastern seaboard of the United States and basically stops at the Appalachian Mountains as far as settled territory is concerned, and where the borders of the individual states ended up. The Treaty of Paris gave the United States land all the way to the Mississippi, but that was basically unsettled, occupied by Native Americans, of course, but there was a strong French presence there. The British continued to occupy forts in the western frontier, and those forts would be instrumental in Britain reclaiming its territory. So there were threats that the new United States faced from France. Even though it had allied itself with the United States, there was a French military presence on America's western boundary. The French were in Canada. The British were still in Canada. And Florida was the territory of Spain. So all around this small country, the United States, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Mississippi River, these new United States are surrounded by not just, the United Kingdom and Spain and France, but the world powers of the day. The United States is a brand new country. That's what the Constitution does. In a really simple way, it helps us get our act together, unifies us in order to deal with threats, deal with trade, deal with finance, financing an army. And so creating this more unified constitution became a critical part of America even surviving as an independent country.
And we'll be back after this quick message from our sponsor.
Tanya, Tanya, Star Savage. Tanya, Tanya, Star Savage. Tanya, Tanya, Star Savage. Tanya, Tanya, Tanya Starcevich.
Hello, friend. Are you looking to buy or sell a home? You'll need a realtor with a proven track record. Call Tanya Starcevich at Canyon Coastal Estates. That number is 310-739-4216. Again, that number, 310-739-4216.
Tanya Starcevich.
How would you describe those early state governments prior to the U.S. Constitution?
The governments of the individual states looked a lot like the government that the United States would eventually create under the U.S. Constitution. And so those state governments had a governor, which is the chief executive, the equivalent of a president. It had state legislatures, very often a two-house legislature in the state of South Carolina and Georgia. So they had a Senate and a House of Representatives, and they had a judicial branch. So the ideas that the U.S. used at the Constitutional Convention to create the Constitution were ideas that were already in place as a successful way in order to organize a government.
And were they all similar at that time? Were they all using a similar model?
Here's something that's really critical to understanding U.S. Constitution today is that, no, the states weren't all the same. They had different methods of electing representatives, who would be represented, what power the governor would have, what power the legislature would have, what power the courts would have. The unifying force behind each of those government, the one thing they had in common, were basic principles that were born during the Enlightenment. There's seven principles of the United States Constitution, and they are principles that the states adopted individually.
Number one being popular sovereignty, meaning rule by the people. Number two, republicanism, which means the right to vote for representatives, not to be confused with the Republican Party. Number three, federalism. While states were giving up certain powers to establish a stronger national government, they were very adamant about maintaining local control. This relationship between state and national governments, which plays a large role in our lives today, is federalism. Number four, a separation of powers. Number five, balance of power, or checks and balances.
The idea of a separation of powers and checks and balances is an Enlightenment idea that the individual states each had. That's why we have three branches of government, and why in laying out in the individual constitutions of the individual states, you realize that each of the states today also have their own constitutions that deal with issues on a state level and deal with their relationship with the federal government.
Number six, limited government.
Yes, we need a government to organize ourselves, but we don't want government to rule.
Number seven, individual rights.
You've got states that are going to be giving up some of the independent power that they have. The Virginians kind of like being Virginia, especially Virginia's rich. Virginia's the most powerful of the 13 states. There's no doubt about it. You know, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, George Washington.
All from Virginia? And why are they so rich?
Slaves and tobacco. And there's that. Yeah. Slave, that's the answer. Yeah. That you've got a cheap form of labor that functions really well in the climate of Virginia, a Midland, Mid-Atlantic climate. Tobacco is what made the colonies click in the first place. The development of the colonies, the first arrival of Englishmen in the colonies that would become the colonies was the Jamestown colony. That's 1609. And they struggled for the longest time. Something like the first 600 people that arrived in Jamestown in the early 1600s, 90% of them were dead within 5 years.
And was that from lung cancer?
Yeah, no. They got to learn how to regulate their tobacco. Yeah, it's because they were aristocrats and they just thought that life would be easy and it was bountiful, and the land was bountiful, just required a little hard work. And so, joking aside, what made Jamestown click, meaning what made England and North America click, is tobacco. That became the crop that made England over the next century very interested in pursuing more opportunities for wealth in North America. And at the backbone of that wealth were slaves. Virginia, at the time of the Revolution, it is at the center of North American power, wealth, and slaves are at the heart of that. We often think of the slave states to the south of Virginia and cotton. That's a development that doesn't take place until maybe the 1790s. Not that they weren't growing cotton up until that point, but it's the 1790s after the Constitutional Convention ratifies the U.S. Constitution. Cotton becomes the most valuable crop that's grown in the United States. So economic issues are huge for independence and for creating the Constitution. Actually, economics, money, trade, you talk about having a common currency. Here are people seeking opportunity. And so the development of the United States was, in large part, a political means by which they could solidify their economic condition or to provide economic opportunity and for expansion. So it's not just for the wealthy planter class or the growing industrial class in the north. It's for the entire country. It's about growing the country to prosper. And without a solid framework of government, it's not going to happen the way it happened. This is the marvel that's the United States Constitution.
Many thanks to Jimmy P. Morgan. You've been listening to Framed, Conversations on the Constitution. This show was sponsored by Tanya Starcevich of Canyon Coastal Estates. For all your real estate needs, call Tanya Starcevich at 310-739-4216. In this episode, we looked at the Articles of Confederation, our first plan of government, and the reasons why it failed. Next time, we'll discuss the difficulties, compromises, and reasoning behind our own current Constitution. Don't miss it. Framed is recorded, edited, sound designed, and musically scored by me, Brian Chapman, and Stone Skipper Sound in partnership with New Times Radio and Topanga New Times. This is New Times Radio.